Jay Adrich is a 52-year veteran of the broadcast industry and retired from his position as Vice President of Broadcast Technology at Harris Broadcast in 2013. He continues his industry work as a consultant and as a technology advisor to Gates Air. His specialties include TV spectrum issues and next-generation digital television, ATSC 3.0. Jay has been awarded 3 patents for broadcast technologies. A recognized expert in his field, Jay Adrich.
Okay, good morning. We've heard quite a bit about ATSC 3.0 this morning, a little bit about REPAC, so we're going to spend a little more time on REPAC. It's kind of the obstacle in the way as we move towards ATSC 3.0. We're going to get an update this morning on where things stand on the auction, look at some of the rules and regulations, the channel change impact on RF systems, and how to prepare for REPAC. There we go. Okay, so the auction's been at least 6 years in the making. A lot of different documents coming out of Washington that have provided the rules and the regulations for how we're going to handle the auction and why we're doing it and so forth. We've already had the first stage of the auction. There are two parts to a stage. There's the final stage rule, which defines the minimum bidding that the wireless folks have to bid on spectrum. And then there's the fact that we have to have a forward auction with revenues that exceed the costs for the reverse auction, plus the cost of repacking, plus the overhead that the FCC has to conduct all of this activity. So the fact that we've got stages in the auction is quite important. We've been through this first stage, and it failed. It ended in September, early September, and stage two began on September 13th, just 1 month ago. We don't know whether that's going to result in a closure of the auction or it's going to be a failure. As of this morning, we were at round 53 of the reverse auction. We still have a forward section of stage two to go through, and whether or not the revenues match up is anyone's guess. My money is on the fact that it won't. There'll be a stage three then that will follow if it doesn't match up, and could easily go into a stage four, and who knows, maybe even a stage five. So here's the status of what happened in stage one. The clearing target was 126 megahertz. The UHF band would have been reduced to channels 14 through 29. That would have resulted in 10 wireless spectrum pairs plus the appropriate guard bands. The reverse auction cost would have been $86.4 billion to acquire the spectrum, plus another $1.9 billion to pay for repack and overhead, so 88.3 in round numbers. And the forward auction was going to yield $23.1 billion. So we only had a small gap. It was only $66 billion. And never mind the $27 billion that the folks who sold all this to Congress said they were going to put in the Treasury. That, you know, that's probably been spent, but will never exist. So if you want to follow what's going on, there is a dashboard, an FCC auction status dashboard. This is an earlier one that was posted at the point of failure for the stage one and announcing stage two. This morning, again, I looked at it. It shows stage two, and it shows around at, I think the number was 53. Last night, or at the end of the day yesterday, there were no more rounds showing, so I was kind of surprised this morning when I pulled it up, and there was one round showing for today. I kind of get the feeling that the reverse auction in stage two has pretty much run its course, and we'll see what the spectrum acquisition number is, and at that point there'll be an announcement of when the forward auction for stage two begins, and it'll be anyone's guess as, again, how much money will be raised. I kind of believe, and this is only a gut feel, but I kind of believe the wireless guys were not playing all the cards. They're playing poker, so they were holding back. There's probably more money there. But the people who follow the wireless industry believe that their maximum is somewhere in the $37 to maybe $44 billion range. So still a substantial gap between that and where we were in the 126 megahertz clearing. So if I were to place money on where I think the auction will close, it'll probably be 84 or below. 84 is probably the first likely stop. But that's my own opinion. So again, how many stages? This is a kind of a repack timeline, what you can expect. So after the FCC runs all the, first of all, after we have a successful auction, we've got at least equilibrium between the amount of money that it's going to cost to acquire the spectrum and conduct the auction and pay the repack versus the amount of money that the wireless guys say they're willing to pay. So now we've got a equilibrium situation. So the FCC runs a post-auction channel optimization. Then they send out confidential letters with the post-auction channel assignment to each station. Not sure why they're doing this on a confidential basis first, but shortly after that they publish a channel reassignment PN, which lists all of the channel assignments for all of the stations that will be repacked. After that, there's a three-month window for the filing of a CP for a modified facility. There will be post-auction filing windows, first of all, for stations unable to meet the technical parameters in their reassigned channel, and secondly, for all other stations assigned to a new channel that want to make modifications to their current facility plan. Then a construction deadline of up to 39 months after the reassignment PN is issued. So in essence, you really have 36 months from the time that you filed the CP until they expect you to have completed your construction. Now, that's just a general position because you're going to see that the commission has some new proposed rules out on what they really want you to do, and we'll see that here in a bit. I thought this was a very apropos description of the auction and repack from Don Rumsfeld. There are known unknowns. There are things we know that we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there's something that we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know that we don't know. I think that sums it up. So in the reassignment PN, there's going to be an optimization process. Priority is going to be given to keeping stations on their current channel first, and then the second priority is to minimize new aggregate interference experienced by any station. The third will be to avoid reassignment of stations with high relocation costs, and there are a number of those, particularly in the large metropolitan markets. And the fourth priority will be to prioritize assignments to channels 5 and below in low VHF and off of 14 in UHF. We've got the land mobile issues on 14. There are some markets where 14's never been assigned because of that that issue. And there are other markets where stations are operating with very sharp tune filters on the low edge of the channel, and they're trying to avoid that in the future. They must achieve 95% optimization at each subsequent level, and there'll be no optimization for stations assigned in the impaired spectrum, which is back in 600 megahertz. So, the auction winners will get their proceeds. They'll have a rolling basis for forward auction licensees issued probably 2 to 3 months after the auction completion. They will have 3 months after they receive their proceeds to go off the air. If you're channel sharing, you'll have 4 months after the proceeds are received for filing a CP, and you'll have 6 months for those channel sharing stations to actually channel share and be off of the channel that one of the partners is vacating. Again, filing the CP 3 months after you receive the PN. And I think, okay, here we go. Estimate of reimbursement costs must be submitted as part of your construction permit application, specifically the cost for the transmitter, the antenna, transmission line, the equipment, the professional costs and other expenses, and anything that's outside of the catalog, and by the way, we'll find out here in a bit that the catalog is being redone. The catalog was originally based on Widelity's report back in 2013. That station will have to provide supporting evidence and certify and make an estimate in good faith. There will be a company that is picked, has not yet been picked, to manage the reimbursement fund distribution and to look at and approve reimbursement costs. That won't be done by the commission itself, but will be done by an outside firm. There has been some hang up in that process. The first company that was selected, there was a red flag thrown by the other bidders and found out that there was some lack of following rules at the commission that resulted in that bid being thrown out. So what will happen is that once your plan is approved, there will be an initial deposit in an individual treasury account that can be drawn down. You don't get a check for the amount. You have an account set up, and you submit invoices against that for reimbursement. If you're a commercial station, it will be 80% of the estimated costs, or up to 80%, and for non-commercial stations, up to 90% of the estimated costs that will be given out. You'll have to file progress reports. At some point in time, there'll be a true-up, and at that point in time, there will be a disbursement of the remaining funds. So again, the catalog is based on some work that was done in 2013 by a company called Widelity. The FCC issued a PN and asked for comments on that. There were a number of comments filed. But over the time since 2013 to today, and actually looking ahead to the fact that this will occur in 2017, there have been many changes in the industry. First of all, transmitter technology has advanced considerably. Gone are the days of IoT transmitters at UHF, replaced by solid-state transmitters that are capable of reaching the same power levels that IoT transmitters were capable of. Cost of services, tower rigging, engineering services, et cetera, have all gone up in the last 4 years. So the FCC has authorized Widelity to proceed with a new draft of the catalog. They're out busy exercising all of the vendors and getting a new look at prices, a new look at what the current technology of transmitters, antennas, et cetera, look like, so that that catalog can be published prior to the start of the auction. We still have the issues of, you know, how we're going to repack all these broadcasters within 39 months. Will it be a regional repack? Well, we've got some insight that has come out recently. In Congress, there's the Pallone Viewer Protection Bill that is tabled right now, but could easily be brought back. I'm sure that the NAB is already urging that happen. That would authorize the Media Bureau to extend a deadline so that no station is forced off the air if they can't make the 39-month window. It also covers the fact that $1.75 billion may not be enough. It's very likely not enough. When I did a study for the NAB, we framed based on the number of stations that in the NAB or the FCC simulations that would likely be repacked. We found that the range was just above $1.75 to almost $3 billion. So it's a substantial gap. And our high number on the number of stations at 84 megahertz that would be repacked is still lower than the most recent number that the FCC issued in this in the modeling that came out in this last PN that was that came out about a week ago. They're predicting if at 84 megahertz the number of repacks could be up approaching 1,300. I think the number was like 1,297 stations. So I would put my best bet on the fact that 1.75 is far from being adequate to cover the cost of repack. There's still the issue of what to do in terms of accounting for the loss of translators, particularly the stations out west. So there are a number of other issues. For example, low power stations will be displaced when the wireless operators issue an intent to commence operations. They'll have 120 days to provide an advance notice, which would then force the LPTV or the translator off of a channel, and they'll be able to go out and look for an available channel at that point in time. We really don't know how many vacant channels will be available or unavailable. We do know that there will be a best effort to try to place translators back into the band plan, but there will be one channel reserved in each DMA that will be vacant for use for unlicensed or what we call white space devices. And in some cases where there is a broadcaster assigned to the duplex gap in the wireless band, there would be a second channel. And this is a bit of an irritation to the broadcasters in that the folks that the FCC originally thought would come to the table and bid on spectrum, Google, has made it known that they're going to make use of the white space. So they get their spectrum for free while the wireless guys have to pay for it. Small political comment there. So we've all seen this slide before. It's really just a quick definition by the commission of what repacking is all about. And this was well defined in the first PN that came out in 2014, where there was a nationwide clearing target. The reason that it has to be a nationwide clearing target is because of the position of the duplex gap, which is an 11 megahertz wide chunk of spectrum that is the separation between uplink and downlink for the wireless guys, and that is a fixed filter arrangement that goes into the handset device and not something that's field changeable or changeable by market. Also, guard bands that will protect so we don't have another channel 52, 53 scenario like we had in the last move to lower channels after the completion of the DTV transition, and also protection around channel 37 if we end up with an 84 megahertz plan. So the band plan looks like this. You can see the duplex gap. You can see the uplink and downlink in blue, and the white channels there are the remaining broadcast television channels. And of course the wireless channel blocks are no longer 6 megahertz, they're 5 megahertz blocks, and again pairs, an uplink and a downlink pair separated by the duplex gap. So when we did our study for the NAB, one of the things we looked at is how many stations are directly impacted. This would be the stations that are in the spectrum that goes away. And we modeled the 4 likely clearing targets, 126, which we now know won't work, 114, which we're currently finding out whether it'll work, 108, and then 84. So we got the highest remaining channel, the number of full power stations that are above the lowest remaining or the highest remaining channel, and the number of Class A stations that are allocated currently above that highest remaining channel. So we see the range from between 1133 and 737. These are stations that definitely will have to move because of the repack process. So those are a sure thing. So then we looked at the 100 models that the FCC ran about 2 years ago, and they did it for 126 and for 84. They didn't do it for the other two clearing targets. And they worked from a base of 1,706 UHF stations that are eligible. These are full power and Class A's, no LPTVs in the group. And these were stations that were deemed to be eligible at that time. And that number has not changed. So how many stations need to be eliminated in that clearing target? And it's a range. How many stations would remain on channel, and how many stations would be required to repack? Now, I will point out that the numbers that we show here, and these are numbers that we worked, Bob Weller at NAB, Bruce Franca, myself, several others worked on these. We applied an optimization factor because in the original simulations, there were moves that were what I call unwarranted. For example, I'll pick New York City as an example where they had the CBS station moving to the NBC channel and the NBC station moving to another channel. Well, why would you do that? Okay, it's just unnecessary moves. So you have to apply an optimization factor, and that range somewhere between 10% and 25%. You will note that this high number on the stations required to repack is lower than what the commission recently released. And I don't believe they applied an optimization factor to their numbers, but that's not been verified. Here we are at 84 megahertz. So again, the same universe of stations, 1706. Stations cleared, estimated to clear the spectrum between 222 and 249. Stations remaining on channel are 433 down to 262, and required to repack somewhere between 1,020 and 1,164. So I get the question quite frequently from guys who come up and say, well, how likely is my station going to be for repack? Well, certainly if you're within the clearing target and not participating in the auction, I'd say you're at definitely 100%. If you're a UHF station participating in the auction with an election to move to VHF, then and it assumes that your bid to move was accepted, because that's up to the commission to decide whether they really need you to move, then it's 100%. UHF stations currently located below the clearing target not participating in the auction, probably 20% or less, and VHF stations not participating in the auction, probably 5% or less. So you have a station that's not participating in the auction. You're not being forced to repack, but could you be impacted? Well, a lot depends on whether or not you share a stack on a tower, and you might be the guy on top and the guy underneath has to replace his antenna. Obviously, you're going to be impacted. It might be a candelabra, and there might be some filtering to prevent intermod. You might be on a shared antenna, a broadband antenna, where you have a combiner, and the combiner has to be replaced. So there are a lot of different factors. Yesterday, we heard Rich Redman talk about the impact on FM stations on a shared tower. So there are all of these additional issues, and if you're in that scenario, certainly you want to be working with the other guy, because you're not going to be able to file for the cost to cover your changes. That's going to have to be done by the station that's being repacked. Looking at density issues, we certainly have a lot of density issues, particularly along the East Coast and also along the border. All those little blue dots on the north side of the states indicate Canadian stations, and there will be some repacking that occurs within the Canadian band plan. We still don't know where that stands for the Mexican band plan, because we don't, to our knowledge at this point, have an agreement between the FCC and the regulatory body in Mexico. Many of these high-density areas also are situations where there are chained moves. In other words, station A can't move till B moves, and B can't move till C moves. The number of stations involved in that is actually quite high. It's up in the 700s that the commission released in the most recent PN. Back just before NAB, AT&T urged that there be a strong centralized FCC leadership move during the post-auction transition. They pointed out the fact that there are previous auctions that were supposed to have resulted in changes to the band plan that are still going on over 10 years later. There are a lot of things that became obstacles that were not thought of at the time. And this was, I thought, a good move on the part of AT&T, finally owning up to the fact that this may not go quite as efficiently as the commission has dreamed it would. The NAB over a year ago, proposed a regional approach to efficient repacking. They felt that there needed to be a prioritization of the regions for spectrum that's most needed by the wireless carriers. There needed to be a breakup of the interference daisy chains. They thought that there had to be a way to make efficient use of the tower and equipment resources, and allow equipment orders to be staggered, and to clear spectrum more quickly in some of these regions where it is most needed. So they made a number of recommendations. They sat down with the wireless community and could not come to an agreement. There were those who supported the move and those who were against it. In August of this year, the AT&T folks came up with a broadcast relocation plan proposal. It was 16 slides. I'm only going to show you a couple of them. But they certainly felt that there were lessons to be learned from the AWS auction and the 700 megahertz clearing, and even the original 800 megahertz clearing. They felt that there needed to be plans and processes and procedures in place. There needed to be a regional management system and a nationwide plan. And they looked at a number of assumptions. Interestingly enough, their assumptions came right off of the NAB report that we did. And they looked at some of the same constraints that we pointed out. And again, they go back to the lessons learned from 800 megahertz, AWS, and even the DTV transition, where things did not go according to plan. They mapped out a Gantt chart of how the process would go and provided that, and looked at the management of the daisy chain. They have a pretty elaborate process that they've laid out for daisy chain management. So about 2 weeks ago on a Friday, the FCC announced in a public notice their post-auction transition plan. Their proposed plan involves a scheduling system for stations that must relocate to a new channel, and to put these stations into a category of which there are 10 categories for the possible transition phases. They also released a proposed phase alignment tool to estimate how long each station that has to transition will take. Now, they made some interesting assumptions. The tool looks at many variables, including the complexity of the station's move and the tower height. And there are, I believe, many unverified assumptions that are baked into the plan. There are also some things that they totally ignored. For example, there's no consideration for zoning, permitting, land use changes that might occur if you're changing out antennas or modifying towers. Nothing to compensate for weather factors, major tower structural changes, or even supplier delays. They've assumed that you press the button. They even talk about the fact that antenna manufacturers are going to have, in many cases, 20 or more antennas on the shelf ready to ship. Honest to God, it's in there. Read it. I suggest it's a good bit of fiction that you'll want to take a look at. So they've broken this down into, again, 10 different phases, each one having a different ending time. But the ironic part is all these phases start at the same time. So if you have constrained resources and, you know, the Oklahoma land rush begins at the same time for everyone, you're still going to have bottlenecks that occur, even though some guys, if they have a more complex situation, will have longer to implement. So again, this is Washington at its finest. They also have a plan that's going to kind of equalize the number of stations that fall into each phase. And notice they brought our friends in Canada into the several of these phases. They appear in red on this bar chart. So typically there are somewhere around 130 stations per phase, except for the last two phases where it drops down to slightly over 100. So, moving on, we look at the typical DTV RF plant and what is likely to be impacted. So here we see the various pieces of the plant. Transmitter, very likely, unless you've already got a broadband transmitter, and many of those out there are not. Low-pass filter, mask filter, in almost all cases, the current mask filters out there are not tunable. Combiners, very, well, 100% probability if you're sharing antennas. Transmission line is likely if you're running a sectionalized line. And antenna, again, is very likely. The transmitter is likely because of the current age of your transmitter and the fact that many of the UHF transmitters out there were designed around band segments rather than being broadbanded. It's a combination of the pallets, the combiners, the circulators, and the various elements that are within a module. So modules end up being limited to a specific group of channels as opposed to being broadbanded. Whereas the current designs today from almost all the manufacturers out there are broadband. And then you have to look at the cost of changing the channel if your transmitter is capable. For example, if you have an IoT transmitter and you think you can change the channel, what's the cost of that versus replacing it? How do you account for downtime? Because it's not an overnight, you don't go in and dial in a new channel and there you are. You've got a lot of work to do to rechannelize the transmitter. You've got high power RF output systems, particularly combiners where you have multiple cabinets in a transmitter and mask filters. All of these will need to be upgraded. This is the dielectric chart that we've probably seen countless times showing the various line length segments. There are three typical line lengths for rigid line, and the areas where they're likely not going to work because of cascading the VSWR issues at each junction and ultimately ending up with a line that has too high a VSWR. We've got issues with tower structural analysis. There's a current rev of 222G. I think H is actually being worked on as we speak. And in many cases, we have situations where towers today don't meet Rev G, They meet an earlier version of the TIA 222 spec. And the local zoning and permitting folks, much like the National Electric Code, where they adopt a nationwide set of standards, would not issue a permit unless the tower is brought up to that spec. In addition, we have a lot of towers out there that currently still have the old analog antenna on top of it. They have a side-mounted DTV antenna. And in the changeout, they'll end up, because of additional loading, taking the analog antenna off. Well, a lot of people would think, well, we take weight off the tower, we take wind loading off the tower is automatically going to continue to meet the same standard or perhaps even be elevated. And that assumption is quite wrong. The tower structural people have pointed out to us that removing an antenna can definitely knock a tower out of spec and may be a lot worse shape than what it was with the load in place. one of the factors we're going to deal with is the fact that if you have a comparable size antenna and you're moving down band, here's a 51 to 24 transition, the antenna is going to be much lower gain. Or if you want the same gain, it's going to be a much heavier antenna. So here's, again, looking from our friends at Dielectric, you're looking for the same gain in that channel switch between 3,800 pounds and 7,000 pounds. So, and additional height as well. So those are factors that will have to be built into your antenna changeout plans. Going to be a tremendous impact on broadcast technical resources, structural analysis, tower installers, and crews. There may be some impact, again, on the radio guys. They're going to have to look for alternate resources and stations that may be used to using a particular tower rigger that are going to have to go to someone else in order to meet the time frame. So let's look at some planning issues. First of all, staying on the air during repack. Initial equipment and service requirements may be driven by factors on the type of transition, an ad hoc versus a market or a regional coordinated approach. Again, we don't know what that's going to be yet. Your station will very likely need a temporary antenna, transmission line, and either a replacement or standby transmitter in order to make the move. The interesting thing about this, there are about 30% of the stations out there across the U.S. that have some sort of a standby antenna in place. Now, most of those standby antennas are broadband, some are not. So it might be that if you already have a standby antenna, it could also have to be replaced. If you don't have one, but you need a standby antenna or an alternate antenna, to make the transition, this is an opportunity to end up with a standby antenna paid for out of the repack process. And the commission's aware of that and agrees that that would be the case. So we'll see a lot more stations in the future having standby antennas and transmission lines. A couple of scenarios. Here's an on-channel transition scenario, meaning that you're going to remain on your existing channel until the completion of your construction, and then you'll make the channel move. So that, again, is going to require the standby antenna, the alternate antenna, and likely a second transmitter to make that move. Here's a scenario where you move quickly to the new channel, but you do so at probably reduced coverage and lower power on a standby system, and then you build out, you take off the existing, the old channel facility and build your final configuration in its place. And here's a shared antenna transition scenario. There are some markets where the vertical real estate operators are talking about having master antennas with combiners, and I know that in at least a couple of those markets, in order to do that, they're actually going to have to move their tenants off of the tower site to another alternate site for a period of time until the rebuild can take place on the master antenna, and then they would move back to a shared antenna and a shared operation. So how do you prepare? You still have all these unknowns. How do you prepare for repack? Well, first of all, we'd urge you to conduct a facility review of the station's transmission plant. Identify any items that you think might be affected by a channel change. Update your inventory. Work with the transmitter manufacturer to determine if your transmitter is capable of being rechannelized, and if so, how long might it take and what might the cost be. Determine your current tower compliance and what the capacity might be for adding loading and the need for any structural changes to that tower. Sweep the transmission line and determine what channels it will not support. Determine what permits might be required for the tower changes, any building modifications you might have to make, any land use changes, et cetera. Prepare initial cost estimates for replacement. Work with your suppliers. You can get some ballpark figures that can be fine-tuned later once you know the actual channel. And develop a list of resources and suppliers that will be needed during the repack. Many of the group operators are lining up commitments with suppliers and contractors, such as the RF consultants, the tower crews, transmission equipment manufacturers and installers, et cetera. If your transmission facility and tower is leased, you need to begin discussions with the tower owner. If FM radio stations operate on the same tower and are going to be impacted, you need to begin discussions with them so that they can plan for what their move might be. It might be going off the air, it might be going to a lower power and a different antenna on the tower, it might be moving to an alternate site for a period of time until they can move back. A lot of different scenarios there. So here we are with two industry transitions on the horizon. One is repack and the other is preparing for ATSC 3.0. And I think there are two major considerations that you should be looking at that would impact your future transition to 3.0. We heard earlier today from both Dielectric and Micronetics about purchasing the right antenna. And I think there was some much more substantial advice than what I would have in my presentation about what you should be doing there. And the second is looking at purchasing the right transmitter. This might mean a transmitter that has the additional power capabilities for adding that elliptical polarization or a change in gain of the transmit antenna, but also having the right peak to average power capabilities for ATSC 3.0, which has about a 2 dB additional peak to average ratio over what the current ATSC 1.0 system has. So I'm not going to belabor this. You got a much better tutorial earlier this morning on the antenna replacement. On the transmitter replacement, again, the additional 2 dB and having the appropriate capabilities to feed whatever change in polarization that you might be adding. And we strongly add, if you don't have elliptical or some form of vertical pole, that be considered in prep for 3.0. Think about the fact that if 3.0 is in your future and mobile is in your future and reaching indoor antennas, all of those things, and all you have is H-pole today, the cost of changing out that antenna a few years from now, not only buying the new antenna, but also paying for all the rigging costs to take down an antenna, put a new antenna up, and the interruption in service can be avoided. So we're urging stations to think about additional capital that they would have to spend above what the REPAC fund will provide in order to plan for and be in a position to have a transmission plant that can easily move over to 3.0. As far as the exciters go, I think it's safe to say that the majority of the exciters out there today are software definable, and an update to the exciter for about 5 minutes worth of time to new code will get you to 3.0 on the transmission side. But there's still a lot of infrastructure that goes back down the chain all the way to the encoders, from the encoders through the STL, the gateway, et cetera, that will have to be added to make that appropriate change to 3.0 in the future. But those are not covered in the REPAC compensation. So let's look at some of the key takeaways before we wrap up. All stations are possible REPAC candidates. Even stations not required to do a channel change could be impacted. We saw that earlier. Staying on the air will most likely require some additional equipment. The time allocated for CP application and reimbursement filing will overburden industry resources, so that's a reason to start planning now. Preparation for REPAC, again, should begin ASAP, and in most markets and regions, cutover will need to be coordinated and carefully managed. REPAC will have direct impact on some FM stations. Rich Redman yesterday offered a slide that showed the number of shared towers and sites where there are stations, FM stations, that share with TV, and the number's actually quite high. Stations that are forced to REPAC should use this as an opportunity to prepare for the transition to 3.0. Yesterday, this guide called the ATSC 3.0 Transition and Implementation Guide was released publicly. It is a downloadable electronic guide. It is 81 or 82 pages. I should know. I was the editor of the thing. I think it was 82. This was put together by a group of suppliers, Harmonic, Gates Air, Dielectric, the Pearl group of stations, Pearl being a group of group broadcasters that have come together to look at the future of the industry. So there are quite a few of the big guys, the Scripps Howards and Gannett's, Tegna, and others. And then Sinclair was part of this. A lot of contributions from various writers and a lot of good material from ATSC. This is the first guide that you're going to find that takes elements of all of the standards that make up ATSC 3.0 and boils them into one document. So if you were to go out and learn about 3.0 at a technical level, you would have to pull up all of the standards documents and sort through, and much of it is mind-numbing calculations and formulas and information. So you really would have to sort through and spend a lot of time to pick out the gems that really educate you. I did that over the whole summer. I worked with two well-known guys, Sterling Davis and David Folsom, as my guides, and then I spent the summer editing all those pieces together coming from ATSC, and there's a large section in there that follows ATSC pretty much all the way through. Now, unlike the ATSC documents where you start at the physical layer and you work up the presentation, because that's the way it works in a receiver, we chose to go the other way around. So we started at the encoder and worked out to the emitted signal. And I think you'll find it's a great tool for educating the station engineers on what 3.0 is all about. In addition, we go pretty much in depth on all the things you should be thinking about in planning during REPAC for this transition to 3.0. And then we go through and show you a model of how this can be done. Now, this morning we heard from Michael from harmonic on how 12 stations in a market would do it. Our model was around 5 stations in a market, probably more reflective of what you find in, you know, in mid-America, not in Chicago or New York or L.A. And we showed the concept of what we call a lighthouse station that initially illuminates a market with 3.0, and then we transition through that and we end up with what we call a nightlight station, and the nightlight station is the last man standing in ATSC 1.0. So anyway, I would urge you, go to, I know Gates Air website has a link. I think all of the other partners that participated in putting this guide together either will have or have already links, and you can download this. You register for it, and the reason we're asking you to register is this is version 1.0, and as we move through the final development of the standards and things evolve, there will be new information. So we plan to release subsequent updates to the document, and if you've registered for it, you will be automatically notified that there is a new version of the guide out there. I think you'll find it to be a very helpful and useful tool, whether you're a group guy or you're a station level engineer. So with that, I think we've run the course, and we open the floor for any of your questions. Chuck?
Hi, Jay. Excellent, excellent presentation. Thank you. Now, if you were in Vegas, do you think you'd find odds yet on whether the auction will never reach conclusion? Or, in your expert opinion, what do you think, looking into the future?
Well, I do think there will be a point at which it closes. I don't think this is a... you know, going to hit a brick wall and die. Obviously, you've got T-Mobile out there who's very hungry for spectrum, and you've got some other bidders that have their sight on spectrum. And we don't know whether AT&T and Verizon are holding back, which is why, you know, the number was probably low, or whether or not they're really just not interested, and they're going to, you know, do a cursory bid. Again, if I were to put money on it, I would say 84 is probably the first likely point where it would close, and I think the wireless people held back, and they're playing poker, right? And they don't want to play all the cards up front. Let's get the buy price down, and the fact that we're on round 53 this morning is indicative of the fact that the FCC is probably ratcheting down. Keep in mind that at 126, in many markets, the commission just took the opening price. They didn't ratchet anyone down. So think about New York City, where WCBS was valued at just under $1 billion, right? Who wouldn't sell their station for $1 billion, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you own another station on Long Island that you could repurpose and still do over the air. I think it's safe to say that there's a fair amount of ratcheting down going on, which is why we went so many rounds. It'll be interesting to see. I'll hit the dashboard here in a bit to see if another round has popped up, or whether or not tomorrow morning when we wake up and look at the dashboard, we've got a true number for what the clearing looks like. But in any event, I don't think 114 will do it, and I don't think 108 will do it.
Okay, also a clarifying point. In one of your slides, when you were describing the FCC's recently released relocation notice, I thought it said at the bottom something about 50 temporary channels, and I don't remember if you went through that or not.
Well, there's a potential of up to 50 stations that might have to go to a temporary, an interim channel in breaking up the daisy chains. But at the same time, the commission said at all possible costs, they're going to try to avoid the use of those interim channels, because that, you know, that just costs them more money. Again, there's some good summaries out there. TV Technology has a nice summary that Deborah Adams put together of the PN. The PN is a long document. Again, it's one of those things your eyes glaze over if you try to read it in one sitting. But she's gone through and has done a pretty good job of pulling out the salient points and listing them. And I would advise you to do that.
While you were speaking, TV Technology reported the auction closed at $54.6
billion. Okay.
But I have, as part of a consulting firm, I have a couple of questions about the first part of your timeline.
Okay, now hold on. That's 54.6. Does that include the 1.75 and the overhead?
No. It's 56.5 with the overhead.
There you go. Thank you.
Yeah. You showed in your timeline a three-month window to apply for CPs, and then you showed apparently a second window for expansion. My question is...
After the first window.
Okay, so stations cannot apply to expand in the first window, and then in the second window, can existing stations that are not moving apply to expand because they've been frozen forever?
Yes, but I would want to consult with my friends. I work fairly closely with Wiley Ryan in Washington, and I'm actually going to be there next week. They're doing a repack summit, and I'll have a chance to pick their brain on that. But I think the answer is yes.
Okay, so but if a station gets, say they go from U to low V, and then they want to expand, they're actually going to have to file two applications then. Will they get two CPs, or will the second one just replace the first one?
Again, I wouldn't want to comment on that. I think that's an attorney. I'm not an attorney.
I understand.
Thanks, Jay. Excellent presentation. I'm wondering about the quiet period rules. And I'm experiencing this with my administration.
Uh-huh.
As the clearing targets change, and of course we know nothing about what the specifics of the repack mean in terms of our channel numbers and such,
right.
But as they change, we would be willing to do different scenarios, like who would we channel share with or who would we pair up with an antenna, not to mention the fact that in Chicago we're sharing antenna sites and we have competitive bids between sites. All these things change dynamically as the clearing target changes. It would be really nice to be able to talk to some people about what the options are. Any word on relaxing some of this?
No. They've reiterated that the quiet periods are still in effect, and we've got to run the course yet on the forward auction on this one. We know what the cost of the clearing will be. The question is whether the wireless guys can come up with that. Again, the highest number I've heard of any analyst come up with is $44 billion out of wireless, and that number tends to be drifting downward. So, again, I think it's pretty unlikely that we're going to see a successful forward approach on 114.
Since we're not spoiled with tower climbers, having tons of them, you mentioned before that there's going to be some restriction with them. Have the tower crews been directly, have we come to them directly about this, or is that on the, does each individual station have to talk to each tower company about this? So are they aware that this is coming up?
Oh, they're most definitely aware. Most of the tower rigging firms have been in a dry hole since 2012, right, when the freeze went on. And there are fewer companies out there because of the freeze. They're looking at this as their next golden opportunity. There are one or two companies that are gearing up by adding or intending to add crews. There are others that are, dusting off the gin pole and making modifications and acquiring a new winch and doing things like that. But still, the number of qualified crews, and I want to stress the qualified part, is probably limited for heavy antennas and tall towers, probably limited to no more than about 22 to 24 crews. We did a very in-depth study for NAB and talked to the majority of the tower companies out there and got their input. That was countered by the folks at T-Mobile. They hired a guy out of Florida and a Hammett Edison to debunk the NAB report. And, you know, there are 46 tower crews, and it's going to grow to 70-something. Yeah, if you want to climb a 125-foot monopole and pick up a 50-pound antenna, there are that many crews out there. You know, it's a case, I think, where at least the big group broadcasters that I'm aware of are already out there making deals with the tower companies. I don't think the FCC, first of all, I think the FCC bought into the T-Mobile analysis in terms of tower crews and the approach. And that, you know, that's going to be a train wreck when it happens. And then the other piece of that is I don't think they understand that many of these group broadcasters are not willing to just willy-nilly go out and pick an available crew just because they're available. They're going to use the guys that are familiar with their tower. And that's why they're out busy making deals now.
Excellent presentation. I have some experience in the cellular industry as well as broadcasting. Previous auctions to the cellular industry, they've said X millions of dollars they'll give for the spectrum, and then they come up with about half of it. And this has consistently happened over the years. Why does anybody think that's going to change?
You know, I don't have any experience there, Gary, I know that at least one of the bidders, T-Mobile, is very hungry. You know, they have very little spectrum compared to the other guys, and they're probably the single largest bidder in this whole process. Every qualified bidder had to be able to provide some indication of financial resources to be qualified going into this. So I don't think they can walk away from a bid once they've made it.
Well, they had to do that previously too. And it's, the business is so competitive.
Right.
That, you know, betting on, you know, on a roll of the dice, I don't know. It's going to get interesting.
Sure is.
Just to drill down a little farther on the 25 crews, this isn't 25 companies. That's 25 five-man crews.
That's right.
So we're talking about 125 people to facilitate all this tall tower build-out, and that's tough in 39 months.
Yeah, on top of that, if you look at their planning tool, the amount of time they're allocating for on-site for each of these projects is pretty limited. Much lower than the feedback that we got from the tower crews when we did the survey for NAB.
Hi, Jay. I have one more. I have a grapevine planted in my backyard, and I heard from the grapevine that there might be some of the wireless players that are thinking of offering to pre-finance a move in order to speed up a broadcaster's transition. Which begs the question, is this simply a financial thing, or is the resources the bigger part of the picture of repacking?
Well, actually, it's no secret that T-Mobile invested in ERI. Tom is busy, you know, building buildings and supposedly ramping up for additional tower crews and bringing on engineers, all financed. I call it Tom's retirement program. By T-Mobile, they are definitely, as I said, they're hungry and they need spectrum in a hurry, and that's why they refuted the NAB studies that were done in order to solidify their position. So I think it's unfortunate that the commission bought into those just because there was a name of a what was once a reputable engineering firm on, you know, on the cover of the report. There were some very bad assumptions in the, in those studies. But yes, my understanding that they are willing to throw money at the problem.
Jay, did you happen to notice on the phases table in the transition public notice, none of the phases extended to 39 months?
Yes.
You did. Is that intentional?
That's because the T-Mobile report said, oh, no problem. This can be done under 39 months. No problem. So the commission bought into this hook, line, and sinker. If you look at the NAB report, it paints an entirely different picture. Okay, we looked at all of the resources and built a Gantt chart of, you know, of what it would take to get the job done, and it was definitely a much longer project, even at a reduced number of stations to repack. And the interesting thing again is that the FCC's number that they're touting now is higher than our analysis. So who knows?
That it? All right, excellent, great.
Thank you for being a great audience.
Presentation, Jay.